Indeed, it's another Base Podcast.
Well, hello there, and welcome to another episode of Oh Great, It's Another Base Podcast. Happy New Year, Sam.
Yeah, Happy New Year, Eric. We are hopefully starting this year with a boom.
Yeah, with a bang.
Yes, and some slap as well.
Slap of the baseman.
Yes. So, I guess we should summarize 2022. Musically, was there anything particularly enjoyable?
You mean like new releases and whatnot?
Yeah.
I mean, yes, there was. I mean, 2022 felt kind of like, you know, the gears started turning again after the whole pandemic lockdown, 2020 and 2021, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
I mean, there was new stuff from Haken, Winery Dogs.
Yeah.
Let's see, new Metallica. We got a new Metallica song as well. So there were a lot of singles released. I guess I have a feeling that more and more bands, even the big ones, are kind of adapting the, you know, release lots of singles before releasing an album approach. Which I have mixed feelings about that. I totally agree with that. You have to adapt to, you know, the way things are working, the way people are listening to music these days. But it's kind of sad in a way.
Yeah, and the problem is with a lot of like single releases, if they release a short album, you know, we already had three singles, and there's only four more tracks on the album. And one of them is just an intro track. You've already heard the entire album, basically.
Yeah, I think it was Periphery who did like, I don't know if it was like six singles or something from one of their albums. I mean, and I totally understand it. And yeah. I mean, it's nothing against the bands who do it. I mean, I do it myself with my, whenever I release stuff, we try to release as many videos and stuff as possible. But I mean, the cult of the album, full length album, is I wouldn't say it's dying, but it's changing, and it's hard to I think it's hard to motivate for a band to justify, I should say. It's hard to justify releasing an album. I think you need to like put things out there in that way.
I agree, and it's like we were both born in the late 80s, right? So we grew up in the 90s basically, and we had cassette tapes, we had CD players. And like you say, the cult of the album, when I listen to an album, I listen to the album. I want to have that whole, not just songs that's just like taken out of context. I want the whole thing, you know?
Yeah, the full experience.
Yeah.
Of, you know, the sequencing is such an important aspect of it as well.
Absolutely.
I mean, I try to do that as well, and that's actually one of my few New Year's resolutions, is actually to listen to more music, because I don't know why it is. I think it's that every time that I'm by myself during the evenings, I just sit there and practice bass instead instead of listening to new music. And I think I should probably try and incorporate, you know, listening to new stuff and learning new stuff. And or just enjoying new music. I think I need to really stick with that.
You know, my problem is when people recommend music to me, I can't help to pick it apart. I'm musically damaged, as you say.
Yeah. Yrkesskada, as we say in Swedish.
And I don't know, sometimes you don't see the forest for all the trees, you know, like sometimes you get caught up in the details. But then again, in music, when sometimes something just sounds so downright bad or stands out in a way that you can't ignore, then it's hard to get over for me.
Yeah, I mean, and like to segue into something regarding that, I think it was on Christmas Eve, I put on, was that Harry?
Of course it is.
Hello, Harry. On Christmas Eve, I was peeling potatoes and prepping dinner, and I put on a Frank Sinatra Christmas album, like one of his earlier ones.
Nice.
And I was just standing there in the kitchen almost crying because it was so amazing, because it was like, you know, string section and full on big band, and they had this like vocal group who did like four part harmonies. And when you think about it, like everything was done live. Everything was like, okay, this is one of the takes that they had off the floor. There was no like, okay, let's do the vocals now, let's do that. It was everything was done there and then. And it kind of dawned on me why I think modern music, if you will, I sound like a boomer now, but why why so many aspects of it are not like appealing to me, because it's I mean, it's boring. It's like, it's like with AI art, it's it's amazing and it's cool, but that human element, that the beauty of failure or imperfection, if you will.
And I think that's also something, like Sinatra is probably the most universally loved. I don't think there's a single person that doesn't like or enjoys Frank Sinatra's music. And just like you said, Sinatra, he was a perfectionist. And and if like the way that he actually sings live, as you say, it's better than on the record.
I mean it was just, it's just,
and
it was
a, and like you say, the life in music, I have an example. I used to play a lot of skating video games when I was young, and they had like Tony Hawk's Pro Skater games had amazing soundtracks when I was young. They had like a mixture of amazing underground hip hop, skate punk, you know, metal and everything like that. And they re-released the two first games in a remake that's really good. And they released a lot of new music tracks as well. And the contrast between the old music tracks from 20 years ago and the new music tracks was so staggering to me, because everything was quantized, everything was auto-tuned. And I mean, I know we're both fans of Rick Beato. And Rick Beato shows you that if you auto-tune like a vocal harmonies, it makes the music sound flat and boring.
Yeah, and bland.
Because, like I said, there's no tension. Like the small, small imperfection, who cares if it's a few cents off? That one makes it special.
Exactly.
But in this case, getting back to these games, the difference was so staggering. I had to turn off all the new songs on the soundtrack because they literally, like, I just couldn't get away from how everything sounded so artificial, you know?
No.
And I don't know when that actually changed, because now, like, it's in every genre now. Every genre needs to have those perfectly auto-tuned or vocoded vocals, whether or not it's used for an effect or if it's used to hide imperfections. But the thing is, it's not needed. If you listen to something like Britney Spears, the raw vocals for Toxic, she nails that song. Like, it's amazing to hear. There's so many good, especially female vocalists these days, that they don't get enough cred because they're so auto-tuned to death.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that kids are, you know, they are so used to it that when it's not there, I think, I don't know, it wasn't Rick Beato who said this, or maybe it was, that when there isn't auto-tune on the vocals, people are like, well, there's something wrong here.
Yeah.
Why do, and that's terrifying. It's, and I mean, it kind of has gone the same, down the same rabbit hole as, you know, Photoshopping and Instagram filters and all of that. It's, I mean, I've seen these, you know, these clips of, you know, models on Instagram who like, okay, here's what I really look like. Here's how we do it in the pictures. Like how you suck in your tummy and everything. Like you need to think about positioning. It's like, I mean, and I mean, and that's like the sign of the times, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that, I mean, people can't stand imperfection in a way.
Yeah.
Because it reminds them of our humanity or something. And I'm gonna stay being an advocate for humanity this year.
because I mean, I've sung in choirs pretty much all my life, and a choir usually has the problem of if you start in a key and usually that key gets lower.
Yeah,
if it's a long tune, because that's just natural.
Yeah,
and as long as the choir is in tune with each other, it doesn't really matter, unless you're playing with an orchestra. But then you can adjust your
your ear after reference point. Reference point.
And I remember we recorded in a church, which is the dumbest thing you can do as a choir, because the acoustics can be like a killer. But again, it was live. Everything was live. There was nothing plastered on. Afterwards, we did every take live, and if we had a bad take, we just did another one. You know, we stayed in that church for I think 14 hours, in one day, so it was like we were done at like 2:30 or something.
Oh, shit, you must have been exhausted.
But again, those we talked about this in the last podcast. There are some imperfections to music, but those imperfections are what makes it interesting. Yeah. If it's too perfect, you don't really recognize it as music, but it's more like a MIDI file, you know?
Yeah, it's and I think we. I think it's our job as musicians to kind of, you know, stay our ground when it comes to, you know, the production of things. And I mean, I remember when we released our debut album with 6 Feet Deeper, we got some slack, you didn't auto-tune the vocals here. Like, you should have, like, why should we? Why?
Yeah,
because Sarah's like, she's like so dead on pitch, and whenever she like ever drifts so slightly, it's just it's never out of tune.
Wait, did you get flack for not using autotune or for using?
No, for not using. It's no autotune, no time alignment. Everything was done. I mean, we did. There was no click track on that album. We did the rhythm tracks on the floor, off the floor. And I overdubbed some of the bass parts because there were some like tricky.
Yeah,
tapping things, but I mean, I think the world needs more of that, and that's, I mean, like Greta Van Fleet is one of those bands that I really try to listen to, because they feel kind of real in that regard, especially like when you see live clips of them.
Yeah,
but yeah, I mean,
it's and obviously it's all subjective to a point. I mean, you can objectify music. But then it becomes more of a sport than an art, you know. And you don't have to be a competent musician to make good music, but a competent musician can tell when a musician isn't competent, you know.
Yeah.
And that's just a fact.
Yeah, and yeah, man, we really went down a rabbit hole here.
Well, I figured we'd start this year by having some controversial topics, and we'll get into the controversy later on.
Yeah.
But yeah, what do we want for this new year, gear-wise? What are we looking forward to?
I just shot a video of my new pedalboard setup. I've sent you some pictures. I mean, I got my hands on the new Chux Crux power supply. Which is for the Quad Cortex and the HX stomp and all of that, and I was really excited about that, like the whole year of 2022, and I guess it was delayed due to, you know, component shortages and all of that good stuff that we've been dealing with for the past few years.
The C stuff.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. However, I mean, I don't know. There is nothing that I'm like, oh, I can't wait for this new piece of gear. And it's kind of sad to see NAMM not being in January anymore.
Yeah.
Because that was like a real big moment. You know, you sat in front of your computer and like refreshed all these guitar pages just to see something new. I think it's going to be in April this year. I mean, there's not much that I'm, you know, that I know of that I'm excited about, if I put it that way. There is probably stuff that I will get excited about once it's out there.
Yeah. I know Dark Cluster is finally trying to release the foot pedal,
I guess they had component shortages there as well.
Like you say, it's maybe it's too early to tell. I guess this is going to be a segue into to a next topic about, because we discussed this a lot in the Swedish Basis forums, that there's so much, people are really unwilling to think in new ways and have new ideas, right?
Yeah.
And I know this is the most controversial topic, and I know people won't like it, but it is a topic nonetheless. And I mean, here's the thing. I love the classic Fender P and J basses. They are legendary, and they sound great for most of everything. But that doesn't mean you can't do new stuff in music. But some people seem so resistant to change.
I think it ties in with one of the other subjects that you had written down. You know, that you can't, if you're an accomplished player, you're frowned upon within certain genres.
Yes.
And I guess it has to do with like the spirit of rock and roll and the way that people picture. And it kind of goes back to the way that kids these days want to hear vocals being processed, that it's kind of what you expect. People expect, like when you hear a heavy metal tune, that the bass player is playing either a Fender or a Spector, or you know, something that you've seen before. If you see a Dingwall, you're like, okay, there is something. I don't know about them fan frets. And I mean, which brand is it that has the oval bridges?
That brand.
Which brand is it? Oh God,
Lakeland.
Lakeland, yeah. Mm. Like every time someone posts a picture, I mean, and that's a joke, of course, in Swedish bass community. But every time someone posts a pic of a Lakeland bass that looks amazing, like, oh yeah, but I don't know about that bridge.
Yeah, but it's very interesting, and I guess these topics will flow into each other. So let's just go for it. I mean, take a band like Slipknot, for example.
Yeah.
If you look up the word brutal in the dictionary, you'll find a picture of Slipknot. I mean, I think everyone can agree that their music is very like primitive, brutal, raw, you know. But the fact is, the guitar players are both highly trained jazz musicians.
And I mean, knowing stuff doesn't make you. I mean, we like we discussed in the previous episode. Mm. You know, knowing your shit doesn't make you less. You know, doesn't reduce the feel that you have in your playing. It just gives you a broader palette.
Yes.
I know of a guitar player who refuses to learn any theory because he thinks that it would. I mean, it's true. And he claims that it would stain his rawness.
That's so interesting.
Like, yeah.
Because there's an equivalent in the gaming world called being a scrub. It's a term that's been like misinterpreted a lot because people just use it as a common derogative for someone who's bad at the game.
And I think of... Oh, sorry. There we go.
Oh, that might be copyrighted. But anyway, a scrub is used as a general derogatory term. But it has its origin in the fighting game circuits. A traditional fighting arcade, you know, you have like the stick and you have the buttons. And the reason they call it scrub is a scrub, he would scrub the buttons, you know, like because he doesn't know what he's doing. But then it has evolved to mean someone that doesn't play by the rules of the game, right?
Okay.
So a scrub that loses a fighting game might say, oh, why are you using that cheap tactic? You're just throwing fireballs. Well, why don't you just adapt to that and do something to counter it instead of complaining about it?
Yeah.
It's a person who makes these own rules in his head, right?
Yeah.
And those are the only rules they can play by. And to connect that back to musicians, I think that's a lot of what we're talking about.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it has to do, again, with how people perceive, especially how it should look.
Yeah.
I think if people were listening with their ears, they wouldn't mind whatever you were using.
Yeah.
But people are listening with their eyes.
Yeah.
Of course. I mean, when I posted my Steve Harris bass, the one comment I got was, okay, you need to lower your strap if you want to be properly Harris. I tried that and I hurt my hand. So like, no, I'm not going to do that. It's true. I mean, I've been using the same strap height for like 6 years now. It's my straps are bolted to the bass and are sewn in place. I mean, they can't move.
Nice.
So it's like, why did I even do that? It was stupid of me. Anyways, I mean, like I said, people listen with their eyes.
Yeah.
And that's why whenever you show up with something different than, you know, the expected bass, people are going like, oh, I don't know about that. It's like when you show up with a 5-string to the wrong gig, or you know, or a P bass to the wrong gig.
Yeah. And I've received those comments because I've generally haven't played Fenders in my career, and I've received that comment almost at every gig. It's like, oh, great bass playing, yeah, really great music, but why don't you get a proper bass?
Yeah.
And it's like, because I like playing my bass. It's like, if it sounds good and the music is good, who gives a shit, you know?
Yeah, like did you mind when you were listening? Like, did it bother you?
Exactly.
I mean, I got that when I was using this was way back. I did an Army when they released Book of Souls. I did a few covers from that album, and I used my Fender 5-string because I didn't have a 4-string at the time. And I got a lot of slack for that. Oh, I don't know about you using a 5-string, but I never played the low B string. Like there was never a low.
Right.
But people are like, oh, I don't know about that. Like, did you mind?
Like, yeah, and it's so weird because Steve Harris has actually used, again, we're getting into Harris, classic.
Yeah.
he's actually used quite a few non-Fender P basses during the career. Yeah. The Lados.
Yeah, the Lados. The Lado Unicorn and whatever it was called. And he used an Ibanez, a Roadster.
Roadstar.
He used that on like Run Trails and Trooper and stuff like that. So, I mean...
But I think a lot of it has to do with people projecting their own insecurities. Yeah, I mean, I'm old enough to admit where my weaknesses is as a bass player, but I also know what my strengths are. But there's so much like marking territory within musicians.
Yeah, territorial pissings.
Yeah, that again makes it into a sport. That it doesn't have to, has nothing to do with the art. Our basses are just our tools, and we use the tools we like, you know.
Yeah,
and I don't know. It's so weird.
And I mean, people are always, you know, they are projecting their own insecurities, and like it's like when people are saying like, "Oh, it doesn't groove."
Yeah,
it's like, that's your perception of groove.
Yeah,
it's like when they say like, "Oh, Mike Portnoy doesn't groove," or "Billy Sheehan doesn't groove," or Dennis Chambers doesn't groove. It's like, what? What are you saying? Like, Toto doesn't groove. What? it has to do with their own insecurities and them not being able to, you know, it has to do with their comprehension of things. Yeah.
And again, being proficient at your instrument should never be regarded as a negative in my book.
No.
But it sometimes just is, you know.
Yeah, and it all comes down to, you know, it's like boys at the playground. It's always like that.
Yeah.
You know? you know scale, so that's stupid. I need scales to rock out.
My dad is stronger than your dad.
Yeah, and he doesn't need no scales.
Exactly. No, I'm a chameleon when it comes to genres. I've played everything from, you know, jazz to classical music to folk music from all over the world. And there's always, you know, the one guy after the gig that has to have an opinion.
Yeah.
Always. And it's, why can't you just listen to the music, you know?
I mean,
I've gotten so much compliment from both professional musicians and from like just friends like, oh, you're such a good bass player, you really hold the band together and so on. But when I get the comments, you say, "Yeah, so why do you keep complaining about the bass I use? What does it matter? You know, if I'm doing my job, it doesn't matter what bass I'm using."
No, exactly, but yeah.
Yeah,
it has to do with, like I said, it's projection of their own insecurities and what they are expecting you to do or play.
Yeah.
You know, they are expecting, you know, okay, if you're a good bass player, you're using a bass of brand X, and that's the only thing that's allowed.
Yeah, and it's funny because one of the few recordings I've done that I'm featured on, we played at Svenska Grammofonstudion in Gothenburg. You know, the famous soundtrack of Our Lives and everything. And I have brought a Warwick bass there, a 4-string, and honestly, there was nothing wrong with the sound, the singer, I won't name it, insisted on I have to use the old beat of Fender Jazz Bass in the studio, which was almost literally unplayable. It was so in such bad shape, they'd actually gaffer taped the upper frets because they couldn't be played. and the setup was so bad and like everything. But in the end, I still came out sounding like me. I can hear myself in the recording.
Yeah,
I can hear my sense of rhythm, my sense of timing, and that was all done live in the studio. Everything, no overdubs or anything.
That's cool.
Yeah. But again, I would have been much more comfortable on my own bass. And yeah. that would be my point. I've seen so many studio technicians and producers say, oh, we got to use this bass, oh, we got to use this bass. And sure, if you're a session player, you respect like the customer. If they want you to use a certain bass, you do it if they have it, whatever, you know.
Absolutely.
But if they hire you to get your specific style, let the bass player be the bass player and have their sound, you know.
Yeah, and like, oh, use this studio bass instead. It's like, why? Is my bass broken? Is it? Yeah. What's wrong with it?
I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand it if your instrument is not up to par, if it's like, you know, badly intonated and the strings are old and it sounds, you know, it's buzzing and sounds like shit.
Yeah.
Totally get it, but yeah.
I mean, take Alanis Morissette's You Ought to Know, you know, one of the singles from Jagged Little Pill. Flea is playing bass on that track. And like, you would never say to Flea, oh, you gotta play this, or you gotta play like this, because Flea is Flea, you know?
Yeah.
Whether or not you like his style, you can definitely hear it's Flea, and you wouldn't have it any other way, you know?
No, and you can't deny that he's an icon.
Yeah.
And like, he does what it does, and he does it great. It's like, yeah. It's the same with Chuck Rainey on like the Steely Dan stuff.
Oh, yeah, Aja, yeah.
Yeah.
Or is it Aja or Aja? I never know, but...
I don't know.
Yeah.
But they were like, you can't use your thumb on this.
Yeah.
And he turned his back whenever we're like, whenever we want to do some slapping. Yeah.
That's interesting. And then we have musicians like Paul Simon who wanted, you know, Bakithi Kumalo to play like his signature way on Graceland. And you know, it's so interesting some musicians really bring up other musicians because they realize the importance of that individual stamp, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I did a session, I think it was 2 years ago or something, like over the internet, just, you know, sending WAV files and everything. And I didn't get paid. I was just asked to play some bass. And I was like, yeah, of course, sure. Yeah. And I did a full take of the song and everything and sent. I was like, okay, here we go. What do you think? Oh, it's too busy. Like you want to meet. You never gave me any directions whatsoever.
Yeah.
Just like, oh, you do you. Okay, of course, I'm gonna do whatever. Like whatever I feel like the song needs.
Yeah.
Yeah. You need to. Can you play less? Like. Okay. Of course, I can play less. But you asked me to do what I felt like. But okay, so. I just ended up doing like really boring, not boring, but you know, sticking, you know, staying way more in my
Vexel balls.
Yeah, close to.
Right.
Yeah, not that bad, but it was like, why did you even ask me to play on this if you didn't want me to do what I would do? But yeah.
And that's so weird because even in the jazz world, my second year of community college. I studied with an ensemble teacher who literally didn't let us play like us. I remember we wanted to do like a variance or like something. I don't know, something about the tempo or like the how loud we played, and he was just like, no, you can't do that. You can't play like that. And we were like, seriously, we are the ones playing.
Yeah.
Music and especially jazz is about free expression, but you're trying to like dull that expression. And that's we were close to like just walking out because we were tired as a teacher, and it's like, yeah, screw this, like we can't do this anymore. If you don't let us play the way we want, we're not gonna do this, you know.
Oh, God,
yeah,
yeah,
they literally forced us to not play in a certain way, and that's when I realized jazz music wasn't for me. Killed my love of jazz, if I ever had it.
No, it's not dead, it just smells funny.
Yeah, exactly. Hashtag yeah, Frank Zappa.
Yeah, hashtag Frank Zappa.
But going into jazz music, I mean, jazz is a musician's music, you know. You have to be skilled to play jazz. And that's okay for some reason. You never hear, oh, the jazz was so bad. Oh, the guitar player was too good, or the drummer was too good, you know?
No.
Yeah, right? But they go to
the opposite.
Yeah, they go to rock music and like, oh, no, no, you can't play fast because it's not rock and roll.
No, you can't play, you know, cleanly.
Yeah.
That's not rock and roll. It's like,
yeah.
Why?
But, I mean, music is just like art is in the eye of the beholder. And I don't know, I never understood that. That kind of, you know, what's the word, like discrepancy between music genres, it just doesn't make sense to me, because it limits the expression of the individual musician as well.
I think it like comes back to, you know, who plays it and who, I mean, jazz and prog and all of that. I mean, it's, let's face it, it's musicians' music.
Yeah,
to a certain extent. And it's listened to by mainly musicians these days, or people who are aware of, you know, how things are supposed to be.
Yes.
And I think that's why it's allowed and even frowned upon when you're not competent enough, you know. And that's also a different topic, like why, like the elitism on the other, you know. But I mean, rock and pop and punk and everything, I mean, it comes from, you know, that type of music doesn't come from the need for skill at an instrument. True. It comes from, you know, the desire to create music, and I think that's why it's frowned upon, if you will, and like, oh, that's not grooving enough because he's too competent.
Right.
I mean,
And it's weird because I realize now, looking back at my musical education, especially going into high school, people were always telling me, oh, you know, can't play like that. Oh, you're playing this wrong. Oh, you can't do that. And I realize now that really set me back in you know, what I became as a bass player. Whether that's good or bad, that's something else. But, you know, I was very much into the proggy stuff, and I had really good technique. I could play really fast, really cleanly, but I've lost that a lot because people kept saying, oh, you're doing this wrong. Oh, you shouldn't play this music. Oh, do this. And ultimately, I think if I just put my foot down more and like stood up for myself, I would have continued on that path. But I don't know. What was your experience during your... I never asked about your musical education days, but that was my experience.
In high school, I mean, I was kind of wrong in a way. I was doing... I mean, I was doing the wrong type of metal, if you will.
Of course.
I was really much into like the more melodic, whereas the thing considered to be hip was more of like the thrashy stuff, which wasn't for me at the time. Mm. So I was never one of the cool kids in my class when it came to that. And I mean, I've always been one who, I've always tried to hone my technique more and more and like, you know, play faster and cleaner and everything. So, there was never anything about that, like against that, I think.
Mm.
And then when I went to college, I mean, it was a very... I mean, I found my group of friends, which I stuck to in a way, and like, I never quite experienced that, you know, oh, you shouldn't practice. I mean, there were people who didn't practice, and there were those who practiced.
Yeah.
And that's like the main difference, I guess. I mean, I've grown to love practicing and just sitting and trying to improve myself. Because I guess it's part of like who I consider myself being as a player, someone who tries to improve himself.
Yeah, and I should do more practicing and playing, but I've like, it's like playing with a plectrum or a pick for me. I've spent my entire bass career trying to play with a pick. I've tried so many different picks, thicknesses, you know, lengths, sizes, no pun intended, and you know. Having my bass in a position, putting it lower, putting it higher up, playing, you know, with a classical bass on your knee technique, playing with a rock and roll down below your knees, you know, everything, like keeping a straight wrist, keeping a bent wrist, you know, everything. It just, no pun intended, doesn't click for me. And I honestly can't explain why, because my timing gets completely lost when I play with a pick. It's like I'm a different person. It doesn't sound like me. And I envy people who can play with a pick, because to me it's like rocket science. I can't do it, you know.
No, and I mean, and then again, have you ever found yourself like sitting there like, oh, I wish I could do this with a pick. I need this.
No, that's true. No. On the other hand,
no, and then maybe you shouldn't like dwell too long on the subject. It's like, yeah. I mean, I've been secretly practicing, you know, doing double thumb stuff, and it's like I don't use it that often, but it's a great tool to have for me, and yeah. I found that I have some use for it, but I mean, like, you know, it's like practicing yes, oh, that was a terrible pronunciation. I have episodes where I practice, you know, 2-5-1 progressions and, you know, doing walking baselines, and it's like, yeah. Okay, it's fun to practice, but I never use this in my, you know, in the type of playing that people want me to do. I'm not saying that it's bad to learn stuff, because everything comes down to, you know, you grow as a player, but it's like, do I need this for the things that I get asked to do?
Right.
Well, I mean, and then it kind of turns philosophical in a way. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh yeah, but everything improves you.
Yeah.
Everything is added to your bag of tricks, of course. And, you know, practicing walking baselines expands your understanding of harmony, which always, you know, is a good thing. But
And that's the weird part for me, because I did all that practicing. I sat all those hours, all these evenings in community college, and just like practiced scales and everything, and like 2-5-1s and like all those things, you know, tritone substitutes. And but it's just never clicked in my head, like soloing, especially soloing, jazz soloing. When I try to bass solo, I sound like a rock player, you know. not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's just, I mean, I guess I could play the Metropolis solo fairly well, but if I wanted to, that's like a party trick. So, yeah, and I'm getting sidetracked, but I did all that, you know. I studied the jazz theory. I did all my prep. I did all my practicing, but it's just, I just never got around to it. And it's so weird, because, I mean, usually when you practice something, eventually you'll get the hang of it. It'll start to make sense, but it never did for me. And
did you ever need to use it? You know, was there ever an occasion where it was like, I need to learn this because I've got a gig coming up in 2 weeks and I need to know this by then? Because I found like, Last year, I actually threw myself under the bus and like, okay, I need to learn how to play jump with my feet, keyboard part, which was utterly stupid, but it was fun to do, and it made me improve as a player, and I've been thinking about it for years, like, oh, I should do this.
Yeah.
And then I had a gig where I needed to be able to do it, and I give myself a 7 out of 10 on that gig, like the way I actually got it down. But I mean, the fact that I had to improve myself and had a goal with my practicing, I think that's like a huge part of it. Like, if you have a goal with your, you know, okay, I need to learn how to properly solo, or I need to transcribe this solo by Coltrane or Jaco or whoever, because I need to do something similar at this gig in a month, then you have something to work for. Whereas just sitting down, you know, just doing like that, it's like, okay, it's great, you build some strength, but if you don't have a goal with it, why?
That's a really good point. You're making like an excellent point in that you need to have a purpose for it, and I guess when I was studying jazz, we didn't play enough together, I think, in a band, you know, to like utilize the practicing, I feel.
And that's pointless.
Yeah. I mean, the best practice for me has always been to play in a band.
Yeah.
I find, because you can be a good sovrumsmusiker.
Yeah.
Bedroom musician. YouTube musician, but then again, put yourself in a band and you get lost, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it's a weird thing. And getting back to what we're talking about, you know, about elitism and people's unwillingness for change. There are certain ideas within music education that you're just supposed to accept, right? You're supposed to get. And I'm not talking about theory, because theory is basically, you know, mathematics. And yeah. Mathematics is absolute. That's one thing that's absolute in this world, you know. But there are certain opinions in music that you're just supposed to get along with, you know. Yeah. Like, oh, Jimi Hendrix is the king of all rock guitar players, or yeah. But I've honestly said this before, I've never understood the beauty of Hendrix's music, honestly. I think he was an okay guitar player at best. He was a good storyteller, but I'm listening to his concert from Gröna Lund, late 60s, and it's just so bad.
I mean, it has to do, like, you can't, I think, with players like Hendrix and Jimmy Page,
yeah,
all of these guys, you can't take them out of the context in which they first appeared and what they did to music when they came. I mean, I've had a really hard time with Led Zeppelin over the years, appreciating Jimmy Page.
Yeah.
As an acoustic player, I love his, like, touch and everything he does, but as an electric player, I simply, it's not for me. It doesn't resonate with me because it sounds sloppy to me, because I grew up with the stuff that came after him, with the more precise players.
Yep.
But, I mean, if you were to remove Jimi Hendrix from the equation of history, it would turn out totally different, because he did stuff.
Absolutely.
And I mean, nothing is created in a vacuum. There is always someone who does something similar.
Yeah.
Somewhere else. It's like with the tapping thing, like, you know, when everyone's like, Eddie Van Halen was the first one. Well, if you look back, you can find that Italian guy who did it on the ukulele, and you can find that.
So there's a black gospel singer from the, like, 60s who did it as well.
Yeah, and there is on the Return of the Giant Hogweed by Genesis, there is some tapping as well.
Yeah, love that song.
So I mean, nothing is new underneath the stars and sun and everything, but.
Yeah.
What matters is when it happens and who does it to whom, if you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's like with Woodstock. The fact that it happened and the things that happened there made an impact on history.
Yeah.
And it's like, and just to segue that, or just take another example, it's like with D-Day in Normandy. Like, that wasn't the reason why the Second World War ended, and why we have to put into consideration the sacrifices that the Soviet armies did and everything. Like, but without the D-Day, like, there is such an importance to what happened there, historically. That, I mean, and that's why players like Hendrix and whatnot matter so much.
Yeah. And I absolutely agree. I can still appreciate their importance for the history of music. That's the other point. That doesn't mean I appreciate their art form.
No.
I mean, I fully understand, and I can appreciate the importance of Jaco Pastorius for the bass playing world and what he meant for the music. But his music is uninteresting to me.
Yeah, and the bridge precision tone.
Oh, yeah.
Love.
Yeah, the farty. Yeah. The farting tone, as I like to call it. No, but obviously he was a visionary, and he played bass in a way that's, you know, so unique, and it absolutely evolved how we look at bass players. But his music isn't something I enjoy, because it's too jazzy for me,
it doesn't resonate with you, and that's perfectly fine, I guess.
But people mix that up with again, I can still appreciate what he meant for music without liking his actual music, you know.
Yeah.
And it's the same for me with I was a huge Metallica fan when I was younger. And I never understood why everyone was always talking about Cliff Burton when Jason Newsted, in my opinion, had a way more prominent role in the band. Except yeah, and Justice yeah. for All, but
yeah, it was pretty prominent on that album.
Yeah. No, but and it's funny because he used a six string on the Black album. Not a lot of people know this. Yeah, the intro to
My Friend of Misery.
Yeah, it sounds like it's guitar, but it's actually a 12 string. It's a six string double stringed bass. Okay. He's using. Yeah, is it Wherever I May Roam? Maybe.
Oh yeah, maybe it was. Yeah, yeah. My Friend of Misery is just plain.
Yeah. And it's funny because Jason Newsted, again, he used alembic basses a lot in Metallica, a very not typical rock brand, you know. No. Even though Jack Cassidy and everyone like started up once upon a time, but and he like personally he was kind of a nerd, you know. and still he played in one of the biggest metal bands of all time, Metallica. And like especially when you hear them live from those days, and when you can hear his bass playing, it's just so solid. He never misses a beat. He drives the music forward, you know. And in contrast to Cliff Burton again, he was more like just doubling the guitars.
And again, I mean Cliff, I totally respect the importance of his, you know, the things that he did.
Yeah.
But he's one of those players that have never resonated with me personally. And I mean, that's okay. And I think that's something that, again, it comes down to the things that we talked about earlier about, you know, oh, we can't use that type of bass.
Yeah.
Because it's all down to taste.
Yes.
It's like with food, again.
Yeah, absolutely.
To segue this into something different, because I wrote to you yesterday when we were talking about like themes and imposter syndrome, because regarding, I mean, I guess it kind of ties in with, you know, knowing your stuff and
what we were talking about for half an hour.
Totally. Because I suffer quite a bit from that, actually. And it kind of goes in circles, like sometimes I recognize like that it's actually a bit good because it makes me want to improve. However, sometimes it's just, you know, bad mental health, red flag aspect of it.
For me, the problem is I rarely recognize myself when I do something good. I just have a very negative mindset in general. So I tend to over exaggerate my flaws as a bass player rather than, you know, pushing for my strengths. And I guess that is literally what imposter syndrome is.
You know? And like, I don't deserve this gig, or like someone else is gonna and I don't know, it's a weird thing, and like the whole mental health aspect of it as well, like it's a slippery slope, really, because you can really go downhill once you go into that, like, oh. And I when I moved to Stockholm back in 2007, I think it was, or 8, it was when my brother started high school. He went to Södertälje, and they have this amazing teacher there, Robert Sundin. He's the guy who Henrik Linder was one of his students, like he's had so many there are so many great bass players who have been his students, so to speak. So I took a few lessons from him, and like the first lesson I took was maybe in like 19 or 20 at the time, and I got so much slack. Not like, he never like, it wasn't mean to me.
Yeah,
there was no like mean aspect of it, but he really pointed out my flaws, like everything, like about timing, about, you know, hand placement, everything. Yeah. Like, and I thought I had my shit together, but obviously I didn't. I recall him like saying, after like giving me like this whole list of things that I need to work upon, it was like, oh, hope I didn't make you sad now. Like, no, it's just, and I was like, oh no, it's a bit to take in. Yeah, I'm gonna go like Ingmar Stenmark. It's just break down and come back again.
Right.
And those words have stuck with me ever since.
Yeah.
Bryt ihop och kom igen. And I mean, it's actually a pretty good mindset to have once I, at least for me, when I find myself going down those darker places of myself, just knowing, okay, just break down and get on with it.
Especially like, if said it with a strong Dalecarlian accent.
Yeah, he said it with a Norrländsk accent.
Ja, det är bara bryt ihop och kom igen. Ja då.
Jag säger som Stenmark, det är bara bryt ihop och kom igen. And I mean that's also slippery slope, like the macho, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, but it also kind of works. Just, you know, okay, shake it off. Does it help that I'm sitting here feeling sorry for myself?
No.
Have you read What Does This Button Do by Bruce Dickinson?
No, but I've heard excerpts from it.
Yeah, because he has a few moments of those, like feeling, I was sitting there feeling sorry for myself and like, okay, get on with it. Yeah. Just shake it off and do something.
And
like
he's a licensed airline pilot too. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and he failed maths and physics O level and everything in school. He didn't believe himself to be able to do that, but he picked himself up. And I mean, and I think at least for me, whenever I find myself with imposter syndrome and like, okay, I don't deserve this, or I suck, I shouldn't even try to do this. Okay, what is it about myself that I'm currently, you know, what makes me go up my own bum hole about this?
Yeah.
What's the problem? Am I hungry?
Yeah, that's usually right. Usually, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's interesting because, again, getting back to what I said earlier, I don't want to blame it too much on external factors. But one factor for me is the fact that I always was told everything was wrong I did, you know, in music education. But also when I did something wrong, people around me were always so harsh to me. Oh, why did you do that shit? Oh, why did you do that?
Yeah.
And that made me, I think, scared to make mistakes. And luckily, the older I get, I stop caring because I'm just myself now. But you know, in those formative years for me, I realized now I should have stood up for myself much better, and I wanted some like constructive criticism instead of saying, "Oh, you just fuck up all the time," language. Pardon.
Yeah.
You can make it constructive. It's like, "Oh, can you try this, or could you try doing like this, or changing like that?"
Yeah.
But that was never like that for me. At least this is my personal experience. Nobody can take it away from me. I just I just got like, you know, basically a slap in the face, proverbially.
Yeah. And like I mean, I've dealt with that quite a bit as well. Not in my education, but in my playing, like especially up in Dalecarlia, like growing up. Like, oh, you should know this. How?
Right. Yeah.
How am I supposed to know this?
Yeah.
And that all comes down to the way that, I mean, people have a certain perception of how music should be and what you should know when you're at a certain level.
True.
And I mean, it all comes down to people's lack of being able to understand how other people work. And I mean, I've thought about this, like, okay, you can always find the culprit behind why you feel a certain way and why you have a certain perception of yourself as a player and why you feel bad, if you will, like the whole psychoanalysis thing. You can do that. You can find, okay, it was all my mother who said this to me. Like, you can always blame someone.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. You can always find that reason, like, because people said this to me.
Yeah.
But then again, like, you are you, and you need to find your own footing.
Yeah.
And build your confidence and,
that's true,
you know, adapt those things. I mean, I've had so many like occasions, you know, when you're playing like these.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden there's like, you know, Christina from Wilhelmina. Have you played that song?
Oh yeah, actually,
Because the first I thought I knew it because it's a simple song, but it changes key in the chorus. There's a key change, and it's not like, I think it's like a 12, no, it's not like, it's like 14 bar period. Like, it's a strange period, and it changes key in the middle of the chorus, like at the tail end. I didn't know that, and I slaughtered that song because someone had called it at a pub gig that me and my brother did. And I felt so bad about, you know, because I was so confident as a player at that time, because I was, you know, who I am today in a way. I was like, what the hell was going on there? Oh, you were really out sliding there. Yeah, because I don't know the song. It's like, and I mean, you just have to learn from those.
Yeah. And I guess it's so interesting because music education in Sweden is so abstract in so many ways. Like, take the US, for example, that you have set levels in both jazz and classical education where you have to, like, oh, I've reached level 10, I'm done with the school. And that's kind of a cool relief in a way, because then they know you, like, the teachers know they've taught right, and the pupils know also they've learned and studied. You know, we don't have that in Sweden.
No, and I think we should probably look towards that, because it makes it clear for the students as well what they need to. I try to apply this whenever I teach, especially, like, you know, drums and stuff like that. Yeah. Okay, here's the basic level, here's the more intermediate, and here's the advanced level of playing a simple drum beat.
Yeah.
Because it makes it clear for the students, and I think that the students need that, and there is no hard feel. I think a lot of teachers are also afraid of making their students sad. If you get what I'm saying, like, oh, I don't want to tell him that he's only level 3 when he thinks he's level 4. I don't want to, like.
But that's the Swedish education system in a nutshell. Yeah. We're too afraid to tell someone something like that.
Yeah, we're tiptoeing around things, and it's clumsy.
Yeah.
Because I mean, there is nothing mean about being straight towards someone with what they need to improve. You need to have your, you know, you need to base it on something. You can't just, okay, I'm gonna fail you because you're an asshole. That's not how it works. You need to have, like, I need to fail you because you don't know how to do this, or you're gonna stick on this level. And you have to be clear with your students about that. And I think, and then we have, at the same time, we have this Jantelagen here in Sweden as well. Like, classic. And I think that's also something that ties back to the things that we were talking about. Oh, you shouldn't believe that you're... Jantelagen essentially is like, you shouldn't believe that you're something because you're not.
Yep.
Which is, it's all... Yeah. It's all so backwards.
Yeah.
But anyway,
it's interesting what you say. Yeah. Because I recognize your experience and so much my own experience.
Yeah, and you're afraid to ask things that you think are stupid.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, so many people really don't know. Like, you think that everyone else knows.
Yeah.
But they usually don't. Like, I had a clinic a few months back at the Rytmus, a music high school here in Stockholm.
Yeah.
And after the clinic, there were a few students who approached me, like, just wanted to say thanks. And there was this girl who asked me a bunch of questions, because she was like, what's a preamp? Because I had been talking about preamps and stuff like that. And she was like, what's a preamp? Because she didn't dare to ask it at the clinic.
Yeah.
And then I realized maybe none of the students understood what a preamp was. But everyone assumed that, okay, I don't want to raise my hand, like, what's a preamp? Because people are going to think I'm stupid. Like, no. And
again, that fear of being wrong, or being like, being you know, stupid. That's a common human motive, you know.
Yeah, and
we should promote people asking questions, like being skeptical and like being inquisitive. That's how we learn stuff, you know.
Yeah, and not think that you know stuff, and think that you're
exactly,
because that's the opposite of imposter syndrome.
That's called Dunning-Kruger syndrome.
Yeah.
Hey, let's talk about the Dunning-Kruger syndrome.
About players who think they are. Yeah.
No. Actually, that is a good point. For those of you who don't know, the Dunning-Kruger syndrome is. David Dunning and Justin Kruger, I believe, two American psychologists. To put it simply, the less proficient you are at something, whether it's cooking, playing music, drawing, you know, it could be anything, driving a car, the more you tend to exaggerate how good you are at something, and vice versa, and in, on the inverse. So someone who's really proficient in playing music or in an instrument, they have the meta recognition to know when they're good at their music. And the same thing goes with the other side. When you're new at something, because everyone is new at something at one point, you don't have the meta recognition yet to realize what you're lacking, you know. And that's where a good teacher comes in.
Yeah. And that's the opposite of imposter syndrome.
Yeah, it is.
You think that you know everything.
Yeah, exactly. And the arrogance of youth.
Yeah.
Gotta outplay everyone. But speaking of set ideas in music, the debate regarding a high or low setup on bass. Let's get into that. That's a hot topic for the new year.
Yeah, because everyone's necks are all crooked due to the cold weather.
Exactly.
I mean, I like my strings on the other side of the frets, as Jon Entwistle put it.
I was about to quote that, and you stole it.
Yes! First steal of the year.
Exactly.
However, Jannik Wisdala, amazing player, he gradually raised his action quite extensively because, and there is a good point to that, because if you have a somewhat higher string height, you actually get the, you know, better sustain because there is less friction between the frets and the string going on.
But again, a high setup for Jannik is probably quite low for most people anyway, right?
Yeah. And I mean, there is a difference between a high preferred setup and just a badly set up instrument as well.
Yeah.
There is, you have to keep that in mind, in my humble opinion, because, I like high string height. Do you know how to lower it?
Yeah.
No.
Exactly. And for me, I used to play when I was younger, I used to play so hard, I actually got cramps in my finger, in my hand. You know, I played with a claw, the claw, and I just got so many cramps. And it wasn't until I started experimenting with setting up my bass on my own and getting a low setup that I realized how much my dynamics and my playing improved by having a lower setup, because there's no reason to have the instrument work against you, in my opinion. That's my opinion. And I generally you can't get a good tone if you have too low. But just increase the gain on your preamp or amp and play with a softer touch. It's really that simple.
Yeah. I mean, a properly set up instrument is just, that's the perfect tool.
Yeah.
An instrument is a tool to express music. And if it's badly set up, then it's going to hinder you.
Yeah.
And it's going to be an obstacle to, the Buddha rope that Bill Dickens invented. He essentially it's you put something underneath the strings to raise the string height by 10 centimeters, which it makes the bass unplayable, but it builds strength.
Yeah.
And, playing these Steve Harris flat bounds for quite a while now, I mean, they have really built up my left hand strength because they are so much thicker.
Yeah.
However, I find myself, that's all.
I understand what you're getting at. And for me, it's basically, even though I don't drive, it's like having a car where the wheels aren't adjusted. Because if the wheels aren't adjusted properly, you'll get a terrible, the car won't drive as well. You'll have a higher risk of spinning out. There's everything, it just doesn't run as well. And that's the same. You have to maintain your instruments just like you maintain a house or a vehicle, anything.
Have you ever done a plec?
No, I'm thinking of doing it, but I realized the Sandberg bass I have already has plec done.
Okay.
On it, and it has really low action and just the way I like it already. So I it's not necessary right now.
No, because people have this misconception of that. You put your bass in a machine and the machine does it. The machine is a separate tool for a great luthier to use. It's not the machine that does the job. The machine does the measurement.
Yes.
However, it's the luthier who does the adjustments.
Yes.
I did a video of that last year, or was it the year before that? And yeah. I mean, I wish I could afford to do it on all of my bases, like once a year or something, because it's an amazing way to have a setup done to your instrument.
Yeah,
really.
And it's interesting because also one of the reasons I like having a low setup is the, like, vandrassel. What do you say in English?
Yeah, fret noise, I guess.
Fret noise, yeah. Fret noise is a part of my sound. I like to have that fret noise when I dig in. I like
The growl.
Yeah, exactly. And that's so much a part of me that when I play a bass with old strings and high setup, it just doesn't sound like me, you know?
No.
And that's also the reason I like having a low setup. And I like having, as a joke, you know, you said I like to have my strings on the other side of the frets, John Entwistle. Yeah. You can really hear that in his playing, even in the early 60s.
Yeah.
But also there was a joke on the Warwick bass forums that they made a display image of a bass where they apparently photoshopped or like cleaned up you know, the shine on the frets in post-production on the photo. But they forgot to add it below the string layer, so the frets was actually above the string. Like the string was literally under the fret.
That's amazing.
And we laughed about it a lot, and they fixed it, but it was just like one of those goofy errors, you know. Like, yeah. Everyone's like, oh, just how John Entwistle wanted, finally.
Yeah.
And finally. And remember, John Entwistle did play a Warwick Buzzard at the time. So
Yeah, I was just gonna say
there is a connection there.
Yeah.
But anyway, to cap this off, opinions are like butts. Everyone has one. We will never come to a conclusion in the topics we discussed today because it's so subjective. But I think these discussions need to be had to be able to progress when it comes to, you know, understanding and acceptance of music, because there's so much infighting going on within different genres and musicians that's just so unnecessary. Like, for a final example, we know, like, Bruce Dickinson, when he played with the Tribe of Gypsies in the 90s, they took like a Latin rock band and made them play metal.
Yeah.
And that was so brilliant because you get all like the funky groove associated with Latin, you know, music combined with the heaviness of Bruce Dickinson's music. And that's what made those albums.
Like, yeah, totally.
The mix of, you know, just throwing something that shouldn't work technically, but it was magical. You know, those three, especially the last two albums, Balls to Picasso is like, it's good, but it's not as good as Accident of Birth and Chemical Wedding.
No, it's a bit, you know.
It's a bit out there. It's a bit they're more focused on Accident of Birth.
Yeah, it's a bit split. It's like a first venture. Like, okay, yeah. What do I want to do?
Yeah. And sorry for interrupting, but that fusion between different genres should happen so much more because you get magical results when it happens, usually.
Totally.
Like Alison totally Krauss right. And I forget his name, Zeppelin singer.
Robert Plant.
Yeah, exactly.
Raising Sun.
Yeah, I don't really like them separately, but together they're magical. You know?
Yeah, it's a great, yeah, totally agree with that.
Yeah.
So anyways, Happy New Year, Sam.
Happy New Year, again. Eric.
Hey, all you listeners, let us know in the comments if you want us to bring up any subjects or if you're like, if something that we talk about, if it resonates with you, please let us know. It's always good and fun to read your comments.
Yeah, feedback is always appreciated. And we do these podcasts very laid back. We generally have some topics, but it's basically just me and Eric, you know, talking like we're in each other's kitchens drinking beer. Yeah. You know, and we want to keep it that way, but we still also would like, you know, your comments on it. So just fire up and go ahead.
Yeah, leave them down below on YouTube, and you know, feel free to message us on, you know, Facebook and what have you.
Yeah. And even if you want to participate in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally. We have a few guests lined up with not too like set dates, but we got some guests coming in.
Yep.
Hopefully soon. But if you are a player and you want to discuss bass, I mean, you don't need to be you don't need to be Jaco or Steve Harris or Geddy Lee to be featured on this podcast. However, gentlemen, if you are interested, please let us know and we'll be happy to help you out. But yeah, let us know.
Yep.
And
well, until next time, have a good one.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.